It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Welcome back to both our long-term listeners and anyone who is tuning in for the first time. This program is known as Alaska Tracks, and I am your host, Randy Zarnke. In this program, we listen to excerpts from interviews that I've recorded over the past 30 years with trappers and pilots and hunters and biologists. Lots of great stories intermixed with the history of our great state. Joar Sovland left his family in Norway and came to Alaska as a young man. He settled in Hoonah, a small village in southeast. A relative owned a logging operation based in Hoonah and offered Joar a job. Sovland fell in love with Alaska and lived in Hoonah for the rest of his life. He became a commercial fisherman and also took advantage of all the hunting, trapping, and sport fishing opportunities. In this first section of today's program, Joar tells us about his early years in Norway and his subsequent relocation to Alaska. Be prepared for a very distinct Norwegian accent.
I was born in Norway and grew up on a little farm there. My early years was during the Second World War, so that there was very little hunting done in Norway from 40 to 45. There was no guns allowed. We did do a little trapping, but the trapping over there was weasel, gray squirrels, and sometime you might be lucky and catch a marten. They had some real pretty looking marten over there they called sable. Times I were trapping, catch a couple of foxes, but there was really not that many of them. We were seven in the family, so somebody had to move out. And after my deal in the Norwegian Air Force, that took almost 2 years, I immigrated. A friend of mine had earlier went to Alaska, and we kept in touch. And after a year and a half, I got my visa to leave. That was 1953. This friend of mine's brother had a logging camp in Hoonah at the time, so there was a chance to get employment. So that's how I ended up in Hoonah. Logging was mostly done in the summers at that time. That was mostly for float logs, for fish traps, and piling for docks. Later, they started logging for pulpwood. After logging for a summer, and my partner and me decided to try a little mink trapping. In fact, I still remember the first experience I had with trapping. We were working in the first snowfall in the fall. There was mink tracks in the snow, and my friend Kenny said, "I can catch that guy." I said, "How are you going to catch him?" He said, "Just wait." He went and got some traps, and he watched the trail where he went under the stump. And the next morning, he goes over, and there's the mink in his trap. That's the first experience I had with trapping. But with mink, you got to be kind of careful to keep the traps clean. And I noticed he made a little pattern of the trap in the snow, put some toilet paper down and covered the trap with paper, and then sprinkled a little snow on the top, even made little mink traps on top of the snow again. Like I said, the next day the mink was in there. So that was my first chance of seeing anybody trapping. In those days, Chichikov Island did not have any marten. You could trap mink or weasel or otter. In the later years, after they planted red squirrels and marten, there was a lot of marten trapping. Marten trapping was the easiest by far. At times, marten was quite valuable. Nowadays, the prices of marten, it's hardly worth the effort anymore. And mink is probably even worse. Back in those days when I first started trapping with my friend, I remember we didn't catch very many. First, we probably didn't know how to go about it. Another thing, there was a lot of competition in those days. A lot of the natives were trapping. A lot of the natives we watched, they built little stone houses and opened a can of their winter supply of salmon for bait. The mink got kind of used to that, so they didn't catch all that many. And we started using trail sets and different ways to catch them.
Did you find that the trail sets that you were using for minks, was that pretty successful?
I think at the time when there was a lot of pressure that the mink got kind of spooked, I did see some try even ducks and feathers, the bait set, but blind trail set was usually the best bet. But like I said, the mink was not all that plentiful, and in those days, we usually sold our furs to Sears and Roebuck, and I remember back in 54, 55, we were getting like $36 a piece for mink, which is probably a lot more than they knew nowadays. Back in the 60s and early 70s, mink prices really went sky high. I remember selling mink furs to Seattle Fur Exchange for as high as $144 a piece, and Martin paid good money too. Back in those days, trapping season opened the 1st of December, and it went to 15th of February, and normally you could end up with a couple of hundred furs. That would be a mixture of mink, marten, and otter. You don't get all that many otters, but they paid good prices too.
Did you operate from a skiff?
Yeah, around Hoonahead, we only had half a mile of road, so that was all skiffs. My normal trap line was Port Frederick. You go up one side and stop every few hundred yards and then look for mink or marten sign, and then you set a couple of traps and then you move on to the next location till you covered the whole bay. That would take all day, sometime more, depending on the weather. That's how most of the trapping was done here along the beaches.
Tell us about otters.
Otter is a little harder to trap. They're very smart. If the trap is not clean, even if you put it on the trail, which they use every day, they will reach under and throw the trap out of the trail. They don't even always spring it. So I think the secret is to boil and wax the trap and make a real clean set, cover it nicely. If you use a 48 Newhouse, you can hardly miss. The regular number fours that they used most of the time wouldn't hold an otter. The feet is kind of slick, they're strong, they could slide out. But 48 Newhouse was almost guaranteed.
Do you ever have any of them alive in the trap?
Oh yeah, yeah, most of them were alive.
And then what, just a pistol?
Carry a 22 pistol. No, they were usually alive because I checked the trap every day or every other day, depending on the weather. Some days when the north wind was blowing here, we couldn't always do it every day. I think the furs were much superior in the days of the cold winter. By trapping, there was a much healthier population. Nowadays, there is a lot of mink around, but they are almost worthless. I don't know if there's too many or what the deal is, but I know the fur buyer here, they call them cotton. They're not slick and glossy, they're kind of cottony. And the marten down in southeastern here is not the quality that they have in the interior. They're by far superior, at least it seems that way on the fur market. Back in the years when they paid good prices, you could get $100 for a good otter, and I know we sold marten as high as $150 a piece. So the fur prices should go on downhill.
Well, that would really help supplement the income for the year with a couple of hundred animals.
Oh yeah, definitely, kind of because lugging here in the early days was restricted to the cannery, what they needed for trap piling. In summertime, they didn't operate the camps in the winter. And that's probably pretty much the same nowadays. They have luggers in here. They work in the summer and then they trap in the winter. So that after lugging really got going here, there was a lot more competition in the trapping business too.
Well, I don't think you told us about the sheep yet.
I tried sheep hunting several times, but trolling always closed at the 20th of September, and by that time it was a possibility that you would be snowed in. Anyway, one year we tried that. We went to Northway, I knew the guy at the Northway Airport Lodge, and he was a pilot, so he flew us out. We had 2 hours. He kind of poked around and showed us where the sheep were located, and then he dropped us off. There's a lake, Brady Lake, and we camped there, and the next morning we had a good idea, and we climbed off, and surprisingly, we got close to a band of rams there, which we collected 2 off, and it was a very, very neat trip. We wasn't scheduled to be picked up till 4 days later, but anyway, we had a good time at the campfire with fresh sheep ribs.
Well, judging by all those tales of climbing, you never shied away from hard work
when it came. No, it was always hard work. Goat hunting was probably the toughest. Sheep hunting, I never did get to do that much because every time we tried, we got a foot of snow or something, and we were stranded in the tent or in the mountainsides. Moose hunting is kind of tough, too.
Where did you normally go for moose?
Area down here in those days didn't have many moose. Few at Haines, I take it, but we used to drive up and go to Taylor Highway to Eagle. Someplace along the road there you would walk back in or find moose. I had a truck and a camper in those days, and almost every year we would take a drive up there. We would either get moose or caribou, but it was always a lot of work when you got the moose a few miles from the road.
Out of those different kinds of meat, what meat do you like the best?
I think sheep at the top of the line, or an August deer. August deer is probably the finest. Get them before they get too much fat on. And even this year I went out and got my first of August deer. That's been a tradition here in the last 10 years, that if I get the deer the first of August, we boil deer meat, cabbage, and a lot of black peppercorn together. In Norway, they call it fårikål. I haven't found anybody here that don't seem to enjoy it, so. If you can get used to it and not to pay much attention, I think black bear is a very good meat, but most people that you mentioned black bear, they kind of turn the nose up. I kind of like black bear. You get them in the spring before any fish in the stream. Black bear is not bad meat. But I don't think anything can top good sheep.
Don't you just love that accent? And the stories aren't too bad either. Let's take a break here for a few words from our sponsors. Thanks to our sponsors for supporting this program. Now let's return to our interview with Joar Sovland of Huna. In this next segment, he talks about deer and bear hunting. You were working at logging in the summer and trapping in the winter. You must have taken a few deer to...
Deer hunting is long in southeastern here. It didn't start quite as early as now. And I remember back when it started the 1st of September, and 20th of August. Now the last 15, 20 years, that 1st of August. That was always a holiday when deer season opened, like 20th of August. Bunch of us get together and climb a mountain. Some years the deers were plentiful, and if you had a real bad winter, had a lot of snow and cold, there was probably not that many deers.
So you think it was primarily related to the weather?
Definitely. In the 50s and the 60s, we had much colder winter and more snow than what we've been having the last 10 or the last 15 years. The last 10 years, I don't think it's hit zero in Huna here, which before I've seen it 10 or 15 below here.
Well, let's go back to the deer hunting then. You'd go out with all your buddies on the opening day, and I imagine everybody would take a deer.
Yeah. In those days, they started off at daybreak and climbed any mountain around Port Frederick has been hunted for deer. When you kill a deer, you gut it out, make a pack. If it's a buck, you leave the head on if it's a doe late in the season, you cut the head, but otherwise they always had to leave the head on the barks. I remember a friend of mine, we shot a deer early in the day. One deer wasn't enough, so we kept hunting till we ended up, we shot two more. So we brought the two last ones back to the first one, skinned him out, put the quarter inside the other two, and we probably had a pack that approached 175 pounds. Said when I got to the beach, I'm never going to do a dumb thing like that again.
Now, when you said you made a pack, you mean you tied their legs together and put them over your shoulders?
Yep. They have a white head that I have never seen anywhere else. They skin the front legs, so you have the skin, and you cut the legs off at the knees, and then you put the skin with the bottom of the hoof through the hind leg and crush them, and when you sit down, you put it on almost like a pack sack. Not up and down, it's crush your back. It's the easiest way I have seen to carry a deer. I don't like them, carry them head up, because first you get all the blood down your back, and they're kind of wobbly, and that's the common deal at too. Skin out the legs, thread them together, and make a pack.
And I just one, it was a pretty good load, but when you guys had like one and a half deer, that was too much, huh?
You get an average size buck, 2 or 3 point in the fall. They probably, with the head down, weighs 150 pounds, some more than that. And even that makes a pretty hefty load. Well, if you skin the second one, put a half or more inside, well, you got a little bit more than you can handle.
Yeah, and it's not easy walking.
No, it was a little bit easier before, and it is now with all the clear cuts. Now, hiking up to the mountain is getting a lot worse than it used to be.
How many deer would you try to take in the average year for your family?
I can hardly remember a year that I didn't get my limit, which has been 6 deers the last 25, 30 years or more. I think when I first arrived here, the limit was 4. And for a time, it was bucks only. They had to have visible antlers. In the later years, the last 20 or more years, doe season opened the 15th of September, and you're allowed 6 deers on each license.
When I look around the room here, I see a couple of mounted deer. It looks like you got some real nice ones. You remember the hunt?
Yeah, I do.
Can you pick your favorite
one? There's one in the middle there. I went with my friend across the street, which is a bear guide, and we went down nice street on the ways. We got in the woods, we split up, and there was a big muskeg with a brushy spot in the middle, and I started looking at this, and I thought I saw antlers sticking up, and I watched it, and sure enough, there was a big buck bedded down, so I shot him. That's probably the biggest buck that I have ever shot. 4 points here is very hard to come by. You can get them 4 on one side, which you can see over there is a 4 point on one side. This one got 4, that one got 4. There's one more over here, 4 on one side. But to get 4 on both sides, I have never done it. You get down to Prince of Ellis Island or even Kodiak, 4 points are quite common. But around the Hoon Icy Street area, well, you don't see many even 4s. Then you can see the 2 on that plaque there. That got a real memory behind those. I think it was probably first week of November, driving out the road. I saw this buck off the road. Well, time you get the truck stop and you get out and you get off the road, he was hightailing it. So I got a couple of shots off and I was sure I hit him. But anyway, I had to go out the road to turn around on the logging road. When I got back, I couldn't find anything. So I looked all over in the brush. I did find little blood. And then I saw the brush move and I heard funny crack, and I finally realized a bear had gotten to the deer before I got back, and he was already getting into the rib cage. Brush so thick, you can only see about 10 feet. And with the 270, I thought I think I better back off. That I donated to the bear. But you see, the race and that one have two antlers on the same plaque. Is the next morning I went back out and I thought, I'm going to see if I can figure out if he's still hanging around there. Well, while I was sitting there trying to figure out what to do, here comes a deer across the road, and I looked and there was a buck, so I took a shot and I saw I hit it pretty well and it went inside the brush. So a friend of mine was hunting out the road and I waited till he showed up and we went down. When we got to the deer was gone. There was just a little blood and that was all. So a week later I took my old 300 Werribee and I walked in there and I found where there was two sets of antlers in the same bed where the bear had eaten both of them at the same place. Unbelievable. So that's all I got. Two sets of antlers on one plaque. That's quite common around here now that they lose deers to the bears. If you shoot them in the clear cut, a lot of time a bear will get to the deer before you do.
So there must be a lot of bears around.
Well, too many, in my opinion. When you look at that bear hide over there, you look at that skull, that is probably the biggest bear that's been shot in southeastern Alaska in the last 40 years. That one scored 27 and a half inches.
What was the story there?
See, that was back in 79. A neighbor high school kid liked to hunt, and he climbed a mountain as we usually did in those days. He shot a big buck and got a little too late getting home, so he had to leave the deer when it got dark. The next morning, him and his dad went back to retrieve it. A bear had found it, and he was guarding it. And between the two of them, they only had a 243 rifle. They didn't want any confrontation. So we heard about this. So that high school kid and one of my kids, we went out there to see what this was all about. We heard about that big bear. Well, it was a couple of miles out in the muskeg. It had snowed a little bit that night, and we did see when we got close that there was fresh bear tracks around, and they were big. And we got close to where the deer was left. The bear didn't hesitate for a minute. Soon as he noticed there was company, he charged. Took a lot of shooting, but anyway, he ended up losing the battle. Far as I know, that is the biggest bear skull that has been measured in southeastern for at least 40 years.
We were talking a little bit about brown bear populations. Why don't you tell us what your observations are there?
I think it's too damn many. For one thing, we have on the Chichikov Island here at least a couple of hundred miles of road, which you are restricted to walk in only if you're bear hunting. You can't drive. There is probably more bears around. For one reason, if guide with a paying client, he's not going to shoot just any bear. They want a big bear. So she bears and cubs seem to have increased more than they used to be.
And you think that maybe the adult boars had been killing some of the cubs?
Oh, yeah, fact. I think that have probably a bearing on it. I've seen at the garbage dump here, when a she-bear comes in the spring, they sometimes have three or even four cubs, and it's not too long before they lose one, they lose two, and sometime before the summer's out, they only end up with one. Their big old boars will kill the cubs. But there's another reason, too. The bear season used to be in southeastern until the 15th or 20th of June. Now it closes the 20th of May. And at the 20th of May, like it was this year, the snow is still covering most of the flat where the bears feed on the grass. Half of them, I don't think, is out of hibernation at the time bear season closed. In the fall, it's closed in this area entirely. I guess they do now have a short station in a small area around Hoonahair, which we had a real problem a few years ago with bears coming into town. They even were killing dogs, breaking into smokehouses, and really created a real problem. Then they did open a very small area right around town here for a couple of weeks in the fall, which it probably helped some. But I don't think that spring season should have been cut so short. And you still have snow on the ground in May. The bears are still hibernating.
More great stories from a master storyteller, Yoar Sovland of Hoonah. I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. If so, be sure to tune in to Alaska Tracks next week, and we'll wrap up our interview with Yoar. See you then.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.